It's Wednesday, October 31st, 2007, and you're listening to episode 76 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Adam.
My name is Luke.
My name is John.
And
this is what you get for sitting in my chair. Yeah. You know that, right?
All right.
Yeah. This is kind of backwards for me.
Right along with the predictable introduction jokes, this is probably a good time to tell you guys the parody contest is over. We had two entries, and quite frankly, we found both of them so entertaining that rather than picking, we're just going to declare two winners. So what we're probably going to do is go ahead and play both of those parodies at the end of this episode. So be sure to stick around and hear both of those. And also, we will get in touch with the winners of, well, both winners, and make sure we get their prizes to them.
Say, good job, guys. It was really funny.
Yeah, they were very funny. They were very funny. And when you hear them, you will understand that we stood by what we said, which is this is going to be proof that we can take it as good as we give it. So, because they honestly are pretty brutal.
That's me.
Hey, they wouldn't have known, Chuck.
I know they do.
Worldwide Wing Night 3. Click the link on the show notes for more information. We have a reserved location here in St. Louis. Hope you guys will join us that Saturday, November 10th. And one last thing. This really is an announcement. This is more of a discussion topic. But I got a private message from a guy whose forum handle is Skyrocket, who kind of said something we've said in a previous episode, but it's worth repeating, which is if you are done with your old role-playing game books, either because you're tired of that game or you've moved on to a new edition,
or because you bought Shadowrun,
a great thing to do with them is to donate them to your local library, because that way they get on the shelves and people come in browsing around, see them. It's a great way to expand the hobby and to make those resources available to other people. So don't neglect your local libraries when you are trying to figure out what to do with your old role-playing resources.
And I've heard of several people who actually set up games in the library, like have a library game to introduce new people.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you have to be really quiet?
Only if you have a stupid librarian.
So, Luke, you asked me to write up there that this week you got outed.
I got outed.
What exactly does that mean?
Oh, come on.
I got outed. I was working hard and decided, you know what I need? I need to go to Michael Scott's favorite restaurant and get me some bites to eat. So I went to Chili's, and it was a good time. I decided, hey, I want to be entertained while I'm here because I don't like to generally go eat alone. But
uh-oh.
So I bring a book. What book do I bring? Changeling the Lost.
Danger, Will. Oh,
thinking,
not Savage World.
Yeah, I've read Savage World.
Well, how many
Worlds.
Times has he read Savage?
Exactly. And Changeling the Lost is a much more entertaining read. It's more of a story. Anyway, okay. I just picked it up. I head to the restaurant with that in tow because it's 2 o'clock. I'm thinking nobody's going to be there. Nobody's going to mind. I'm reading a huge geek book. I walk through the door. I see the guy who seats people and, you know, kind of got my height, little bigger guy, big glasses. I'm like, oh, hell. He looks down. I see him look at the book with a twinkle of recognition, but he doesn't say a word.
Run.
Yeah. And I'm
run,
like,
Luke,
I'm
run.
Like, no. Baby back ribs. I'm like, Chili's, gotta go. So I get seated. I start reading. I get another actual server, order my food. About 5 minutes later, I feel a hand rest on my shoulder. I hear, your geek is showing, sir. And it's that guy. His name's Marty. And we end up talking. He's a pretty cool guy. Like, usually when this happens, it's a really bad experience, but this guy was pretty cool. And so I gave him a couple of cards for Fear the Boot, told him about the con we're putting on, and he seemed very receptive. So
we're not putting that con on.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, it's not Fear the Boot. So hopefully he's listening now, because, hey, Marty, good food. Thanks, buddy. So that was me. I got outed this week, and it was not a bad experience this time. As opposed to the other guy who works at I have my own practice, but I work at a different place a couple days a week occasionally. And a guy there is trying to out me, but I refuse to acknowledge that I know what a role-playing game is, and it's working out pretty well
Lucius.
For me.
I see your dice sack.
That's not a dice sack. I keep my lunch in there. I'm on a diet.
Our next topic has been demanded by the fans. They have requested it in the episode 75 thread.
Zercher, I blame you.
Is this like reverse Pokemon?
Yes. Back in your Pokeball,
use
Zercher.
Your splash attack.
They want to know about capital ship combat,
God.
In my view.
I'm going to hang up the headphones.
We're out of here.
Actually, can you just do
mission
this at the end?
Yeah, do the rest of the show.
Under attack.
If you do this at the end, we can all just leave before you set up.
I can just sit here and talk.
It's going to be an hour and a half episode.
For 10 minutes.
It'll bonus episode with just me. Actually, the topic we're really going to talk about is house rules.
Oh, no, nobody likes
as they
house
relate
rule.
To broadside ship combat.
Do you house rule that into taking every game
the,
you play?
Taking the good old role-playing game books.
How many hard-coded capital ship broadside rules have you seen in RPG books?
Point taken.
Taking the good old RPG books and marking them up to the taste of your group. The good, the bad, the ugly, and how to do it right. What is the worst house rule any of you guys have ever seen?
Chattel tech.
Explain chattel tech.
Describe that. Even I don't know what
I know
is.
What chattel tech is.
I'm going to go ahead and go with chattel tech, too.
You
so
go ahead.
Go ahead, Adam.
Pick something different, guys. Tell a good story. Come on.
No, this is that
this
bad.
Be a good story.
Okay.
Have you ever played Battletech, Luke?
I've played the miniatures game. Yes.
And you know how most of the time you have a pretty decent chance of hitting your enemy?
Yes.
Okay, well, take that target number and subtract 4 from it.
Yes. On 2d6, that's kind of ridiculous.
Yes.
Imagine playing D&D where everyone's armor class was just half of what it was supposed to be, and there was no other balancing mechanism to counter that. Everyone would hit everything every time.
The explanation that was given to me for chattel tech was that, well, we were playing the game and nobody could ever hit anybody else. And I'm sitting here thinking about this as someone who's obviously run Battletech for a very long time. It's like the thought in the back of my mind is, well, maybe you're running the game wrong, but
you're doing it wrong.
We were doing it wrong.
Rather than go through that line of thought, it just became, we'll just keep the rules that we've been using, which weren't correct, and just apply a -4, which in Battletech is a good thing. A -4 to your target number helps you.
Yeah.
And on 2d6, -4
at this scale,
-4
you below 0 on your 2-hit number.
Yeah. So it pretty much became everybody hits everything. Worst house rule I've ever seen was actually in a Rifts game.
See, I was going to say Rifts 4, the worst.
That's a collision of badness.
I was playing a mage, which in the...
Why weren't you playing a juicer? Juicers are so much better.
No, it's a glitter boy. You play glitter boy no matter what. But in the great cosmology of character classes or OOCs or whatever they're called, OCCs, I guess it is, within Rifts, a mage is already on the bottom end. And the guy I was playing with, technically I was supposed to be able to cast 2 spells around. And he changed that so I had a casting time so I could cast a spell every other round.
On the bright side, you still weren't as bad as a rogue scholar.
This class that was already quirky to begin with ended up being just absolutely freaking worthless.
Well, I can top that. I can top that with a magic class because when I was in college, I visited a friend who went to a very fundamentalist Christian college. And he had a role-playing group there who was running, they just started running Council of Worms, which is a AD&D second edition setting where you all play dragons.
Right.
Okay. But I went to, like, Martin Luther, Germany.
No, different
I just put those two and two together.
So, their house rule, because this guy's girlfriend did not like magic or dragons or anything like that, was there can be no magic in your D&D game. And I was not told this beforehand, so I rolled up a white dragon, which is a magic user. That's all it
does.
I
thought the white dragons were the stupid ones.
They were super smart.
Feral animals in the glaciers.
Luke looks offended.
In this one, they were magic users, and it was awesome. And nobody. And I came there and says, oh, yeah, we don't use magic. I'm like, well, can I roll up a different character? Oh, no, we got to get started. So that was my game. I got to play the dragon that did nothing, and
it
did suck.
It's any consolation, I don't think I could name a dragon breed that you could be without magic that would be any good at all.
Yeah, exactly, but people were better. Red dragons, black dragons.
Well, yeah, red dragon was like the bad gold dragon, just better at everything, because that's what it is.
I'm a red dragon.
They're not balanced against each other.
No.
I played a Shadowrun game with no magic, and that worked out significantly better, because Shadowrun is not as magic-reliant as D&D. You can still make very effective characters based on skills, contacts, cyberware,
well,
any
if you were going to take
things.
Magic out of D&D, you've got to take the magic classes out.
Well, Dan,
out.
Your solution is to play Star Trek.
Well,
I mean, that's what you should do. There's a lot of great sci-fi and even straight historical gaming out there. If magic offends you, don't play D&D.
Yeah, you're absolutely 100% right. I mean, Star Trek, Battletech, Renegade Legion, Traveler. I mean, how many games out there have there been over the years that do not require
exactly
any shred of magic in them to begin with? So, yeah, if that offends you, I don't see why you'd want to take it.
But then you can't be the Scion of Masada.
He wanted to play dragons because dragons are that cool. Although significantly less cool when you take magic out
take
and make
magic,
my character suck.
Now effectively you're a fire-breathing dinosaur.
Tell them that you're offended.
I didn't even breathe fire. I breathed like, I don't even think I breathed ice. I breathed like crap.
Yeah,
I breathed like asbestos. It was like the asbestos dragon. And it took 20 years to kill anything. That's how it was. It was terrible.
I'm scared of the asbestos dragon.
All right. What are some good house rules you've seen? And let's talk about the positive role that house rules can play within a game. The first, most important one I can think of is to stop irritating player habits.
Yes.
This is the biggest one. When your players are annoying the ever-living crap out of you, it's time for a house rule. For example, going back to Battletech, but this has happened in any miniature game we've played, D&D 3.0, whatever, okay? We have this problem where people roll their dice, and we're playing on this huge play surface. We've got box lids. We've got all kinds of places they can roll their dice, but no. Every jackass at the table can only roll their dice one place, which is straight down the middle of the map. And so we started adding rules for bowling that basically if you knock over a fig, your character or your mech or whatever game we're playing falls down, takes the appropriate damage, loses the appropriate turns, and it finally stopped people from rolling their damn dice straight down the middle
of
the map.
I think that's a better dice habit than the drop on the floor.
Oh, that's pretty bad, too.
Oh, it's a 5. That counts. Or you see the 1. They just grab it real quick. What'd you get? Off the table.
Yeah. See, we started instituting DRZ, our dice rolling zone. We designate an area. Or some people
DRZ.
Actually, DRZ, baby. It's actually from Hackmaster. But there are some places, like I know on eBay, you can actually buy a little PVC pipe with felt on the bottom where you roll your dice in there.
You know, we just need a craps table.
Or a craps table would be great. It's kind of like a really tiny craps table.
Shockingly, any shoebox will work. I mean, you don't need to go onto eBay and pay $25.
No, sides are too high.
Specialized item.
Got to reach too deep.
I have seen the one I think John was talking about right there, where the player rolls the dice and they fall off the table. And let's say it's a D20. If it's a 1, shockingly, it's on the table. I'm going to roll it. If it's a 20, it's a 20. See, it's right there on
the
floor.
That is an epic dice maneuver.
And so we instituted the house rule of if you roll a handful of dice, it could be 1 die or 20 dice. It doesn't matter. So much as one of them goes off the table, you re-roll the whole lot of them. And
I don't do that. I have anything that fell off the table is re-rolled. But yours makes sense.
Just the dice.
I might start having people re-roll roll their stuff on the floor.
Well, we don't actually have a table as such when we play at your house.
I know. I want you to start rolling in my carpet.
Well, okay.
That won't be a very good roll. It's not a great rolling surface.
House rules are also implemented to keep Frankenstein extended universe template characters out of the game. I was IMing like with a friend from, I was IMing with a dude from my MUD last night, and he was like, so, do you know the rules behind the feral templated minotaur from the Extra Mighty Player's Handbook supplement? I was like, oh, no. Why is your GM letting you do this? It's like, well, it has a modified character level expender of 13. What are you talking about?
That's another sort of house rule that I use with D&D. Once again, same reason to stop irritating players, which is where I'll say, look, we're only using these books, period.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's an official supplement or not. If you came up with the Death Touch at first level, you don't get to play it.
Well, the Death Touch is almost cool.
No.
The 28th strength and the 30 constitution, that's just nothing. That's just crappy broken math that makes everyone cry.
See, my favorite house rules are the ones that make the game more streamlined to play, because a lot of games out there have a lot of wank rules. The rules in there just because the designer thinks it's cool and nobody else does, and nobody told them no. And you sit there and you're like, why is this in here? This just makes things harder. So you house rule it out. That happens.
If it makes you feel any better, all of the wank rules you put into SOG, I will veto.
That's why you're there. That's the whole reason why you're there.
I'm here to tell you no.
Exactly. You are my no box. You're my wife.
Oh.
Flavor is another reason that I've added a lot of house rules over the years. If the game just has something about it where we want to take a little bit of a different way, like, for example, in D&D, you get a critical hit on a D20, and in 3rd edition, there's actually specific rules for what a critical hit does. I think there was in 2nd edition, too, but it was...
No, in 2E, it was a 20. I think you could take some skills to extend it down to a 19, but there was none of this, well, roll again, and if it would hit again, you're critical now.
Right.
It got determined in the 1 die.
We added a flip side to that where we started putting in critical misses, that if you roll a 1, or basically, you know, the bottom end of your critical hit on the die, that we then had a separate little, it was a short, simple little chart where you rolled, like, I think it was a D10 against it, and anything could happen from you drop the weapon to you accidentally hit yourself with it to... You get it wedged in something, yeah, mm-hmm. And it's where kind of the opposite, where instead of the one hit kill or the double damage or the triple damage or whatever, that you have something go horribly awry.
So many people assume that those rules are actually written into D&D when they're nowhere to be found.
Yeah, they're not.
I told someone that nothing bad happened on his one, and he was like, "What? Show me where it says there's critical failure."
And you know what? Talk about wank rules. It's okay. In 3E, we take getting a natural 20 from something to celebrate to something. Oh God, how many more times do I have to roll this thing? Let's take all the fun out of rolling a 20 on a D20.
Yeah.
Oh God, I got to roll to confirm and then roll a confirm.
I like rolling
confirmation.
My confirm roll. It's like chance for critical. Well, that's what it is. But I have to make it about Battletech.
Somebody just didn't like that there was a straight percentile chance that you're going to 1 out of 20 rolls is going to be fantastically awesome. So let's make it balanced.
Well, falling back on good old Battletech, we changed the Snake Eyes rules on Battletech. For those of you who played it or not played it, if you roll a Snake Eyes on the hit location, you get center torso or the middle of the mech with a chance for critical. And we kind of look at these mech creatures like, you know, they've got all kinds of guns and sensors and stuff hanging out all over the place and exposed joints. And so we change. If you get Snake Eyes, you re-roll the location, get a chance of critical on that location.
That's pretty cool.
So you have a chance of, like, blowing the rifle out of the right hand of the mech or whatever instead of just doing it on the center.
Criticals in Battletech aren't like D&D. It's not just more damage. You actually blow up such and such a component, and then it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I think really the most important thing to remember when you're creating a house rule of any kind is the exact same sorts of things that you think of if you were writing the game yourself. I mean, imagine you're writing this game and it's the exact same game with one change. You've got to look at how is this going to impact play experience? How is this going to impact every other rule? How is this going to impact the character classes? Like stripping magic from the White Dragon.
And the thing about house rules is, you know, whenever you sit down with a game, you're going to think of things you're going to want to do to change it, to make it more torture group, something that works a lot better.
To make it more torture group?
Yeah, more torture group. Sorry, I've had a little beer like everybody else here.
I haven't been drinking.
No, not you. The things you've got to keep in mind are that eventually your list of house rules is going to get so far along that you shouldn't be playing that game. If you like the idea behind a game, but you need tons of house rules to play it, you need to be using a different system and just adapt. For instance, I picked up Scion Hero a while back, and I love the concept of that, but I'm not so much a fan of the Exalted 2nd Edition stream-down system, so I'll probably run it as just a Supers game with those kind of trappings.
And I've seen that happen.
And you'll just run out of a Savage Worlds book.
I've seen
that. Because you're Luke.
That's exactly what I'm going to do, actually.
I've seen that happen. Surprised. I used to play with a gaming group where they were playing a house game, and the history is a homebrew game.
Who was Foreman?
And the history of the homebrew game was that it had started as a West End Star Wars game.
Ooh.
And they had just kept modifying it to the point that
it was D20 Star Wars.
It became
that'd be hilarious.
To the point that they were rolling less than 12 dice.
That it became its own standalone game. And you're right, Luke, but I think you can hit a point where you might as well make your own game, or the house rules become so complex that you make it hard for people to remember or make it hard to initiate new players. And I think house rules have to be like seasoning. It's something,
exactly. That's a good point.
It's something that you're going to use to make the game have the flavor you want. But if you just take a bowl of whatever and just dump half a pound of cumin into it, it's just going to taste like crap.
And if you change too much of the formula, you have the new Coke.
Yeah. Back in college, actually, there was a guy who was a math/computer science major who took Rolemaster and made it so to create a character, you had to use a computer because he involved such complicated algorithms. And what the hell is the point of that? Tell me that. He wanted me in his game. I'm like, okay, well, let's create a character. And he took me to the room, to the computer. He's like, this will take about 3 hours.
I think he wanted you in his room.
This will take about 3 hours?
This will take about 3 hours on the computer. I'm like, what?
He might have had a little Dumbledore in the back of his mind.
And we already know my bad Rolemaster experience already. So that was the sign where I'm like, no, I'm not playing again. This is it for sure.
Even as a man who likes crunchy, complex systems, 3 hours for character creation with computer aids.
I know. I mean,
if you're stumbling through a game for the first time and it takes you 3 hours, that's fine. But
with
3 hours...
You should have been wearing a condom.
I was thinking it.
There are some games that make character creation a game all of itself. Again, I think of Hackmaster and a few others that take a long time. It takes a long time to make character, and it may not be what you want, but it's a hell of a lot of fun to do. Playing on a computer with algorithms, not so much fun. If it takes 3 hours and the guy smells like old bacon, it's bad.
Did you play the Portals online DOS prompt game? It was great.
What is it like?
No,
move north, open portal.
You go to the Aperture Science computer mainframe circa 1983, and you have to type like dir and navigate its DOS and see all this crap that's got buried in there and take this ridiculous personality profile test.
That's
awesome.
Brilliant.
Man, Portal is probably the greatest game
I've
played.
No doubt. No, it is in the least.
My
last
avatar
7 months.
Is now the weighted companion cube. And the guy holding it with the heart.
Oh, the way to companion cube.
I'm trying to convince Dan to play it, but
all right, and John, resistant. I just made a note because people got on us for not linking things
right,
in the
yeah,
show
I'll
notes we talk about, like Luke's rain game that nobody could find because nobody could figure out the spelling.
Hey, look,
so
it's an Easter egg hunt.
Just made a note right there that Portal DOS, if you're interested in this, look in the show notes. We're going to start linking the things
we
talk
about.
No, don't.
Screw them. Screw them. So, work hard, listeners. Work for it.
That's right.
You'll feel a lot better
Google
when you get there.
You actually can find it in the game. it leads you to the website, like petsovernight.com and that sort of thing from the days of yore.
You might be playing the game on the PC instead of the 360 like me. If I do that, it just takes me to my friends list or something.
Can they put letters and punctuation on a 360 screen?
No. Microsoft has its own language.
Oh, okay.
I don't really get it.
Well.
If Tex was here, he could explain it to us. It's kind of like Albed. Which
it is like Albed.
Oh, God.
We're not talking about Albed tonight. Albed language. The deepest and most nuanced fictional
language.
Thanks a lot,
Carla.
This side of Cinder and Elvish.
John and I were having this debate earlier about whether Albed is simply letter swapping or phenome swapping.
It's letter swapping.
It's letter swapping with phenome swapping. There's a guide to
intellectualizing it beyond letter swapping is giving it so much more credit than it deserves. It makes me sad.
While we're on the subject, Luke's horror games.
Oh, yeah.
While we're on the topic of horror, this episode's probably going to drop somewhere around Halloween-ish. I don't have a calendar in front of me.
It will drop on Halloween.
Oh, it'll drop on Halloween. Oh, Halloween's Wednesday this year. Okay.
So, the day I turn 22.
The day after I turn 28.
Ooh, sorry. So,
wow, the old crew over there.
That's right.
All right. So if you're walking around listening to Fear the Boot on your iPod while your kids are getting abducted trick-or-treating, then let's at least give you
and
something.
Drink another whiskey and gin.
And let's give you something useful to take home.
That sounds terrible.
When
it does sound really bad.
When we were talking about the genre games, I think it was Chad mentioned that, Luke, you run a really good horror game.
It's odd that Chad's never played in a horror. At that point, he'd never played under me.
We were talking about stuff
on the forums, and that is my high watermark as a GM, is that I've run some excellent horror games.
Now, we talked about the horror game genre before and gave our take on it, but obviously...
Right. Now, take off your pants, whip it out, and tell us how it goes.
Right. So, as new blood, just because this is top of
my
Halloween...
Am I still new blood?
Ish. I don't know.
your newest blood.
Newest. Hey, okay,
Luke.
Fair enough.
So what are some of the things that you do in your horror game to kind of set the mood?
Well, as I think you talked about in your horror episode, the real key to any horror game is to not try to scare the characters. You have to actually scare the players, because you can't scare the characters. They're fictional. You know, they can act scared, but you're going to be in a much better state if you just try to scare the players.
Right.
So,
in fact, getting back to house rules, there are games where I have instituted a courage attribute because my players were getting so absurd with the things that didn't frighten them that... You're right. You're absolutely right.
It's a danger of an RPG. There's a disconnect. Yeah. There's no real risk, you know.
There's guts in Savage Worlds.
There is. I heard about that. Tell me about this game, Savage Worlds.
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
My character got shot. I lost 5 out of 300 hit points. Oh, no.
Yeah.
As opposed to the human reaction when a real gun gets pulled on
me. Got shot.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Or I'm facing down a gun that hasn't even been fired yet. So, yeah.
Or Dan's got a gun and foretells that Sakurai's going to shoot me.
I did.
No, he said he was going to shoot the children, not you.
You were going to get shot in the car.
That's right. Yeah. It was in the car I was going to get shot.
All right,
That's correct. So go on.
I agree with you. You've got to scare the player. It's not the character.
Yeah, and by scaring the characters, you need to make them uncomfortable in some way. And not the bad uncomfortable, like I'm going to touch you in your naughty place, but uncomfortable enough.
No, that's a good uncomfortable.
That they're not completely in their element. And ways you can do this are always, you know, turn down the lights, light some candles. Dim light always works really well for various things, but also for horror games. Then
I like all Barry White.
There is a lot of sexual references when it comes to horror games. I don't know why. It's very visceral.
There's something to explore. Go on.
Let's talk about that.
A lot of times, whenever it's night or if they're going to a cavern, something like or some dark place in the game, I will turn the lights out, light some candles, and have that be the torchlight. There's usually enough light you can still see the character sheets, but it helps get the players really in the mood. Also, I'm not a big fan of music at the table, but if you can get the right ambient music, a lot of times you can get something that feeds into the game without distracting from it.
Suggestions. What are some albums you've used?
The best I've ever used is actually pretty hard to find. It's a really creepy, crazy band called Current 93, and they have an album called Faust that is a half-hour-long single track that sounds like you're moving through hell. It's all this ambient whispers and noise, and it's really, really creepy.
Is that F-O-U-S-T or F-A-U-S-T?
F-A-U-S-T, as you would think around Halloween.
Okay.
Sean from Chainmail Bikini, who's an excellent GM, has a huge variety of great classical tracks. I'm trying Kronos Quartet. He used to play a lot, which worked really well in our vampire game. I'm trying to think of others. Anything that you can get that is more ambient than not works well. Although occasionally you can go with the kind of a goth or hard rock song that won't, again, doesn't distract, but still can kind of creep people out.
The Rush really worked for your Ronald Reagan Through Time game.
It did. Well, I mean, those are the ways that I kind of set the mood. But then it's all about getting inside their head, you know, surreal images, whispering. Even if you as a game master look unsettled, several times I freak people out by just kind of looking around the room like, so like I just saw something. That tends to work fairly well if people are paying close enough attention. But one of the biggest keys to scaring people or running a horror game is making sure the players are in the right mood.
This really works.
What?
I've been whispering. John and I have been looking unsettled. And you're starting to lose your train of thought.
Yeah, I did. I'm like, what the hell's going on around me? It worked. See,
it doesn't work.
GM technique number 472.
You know,
proven true.
I was just about to say, I wonder how much value there would be in just doing a little bit of research on the basic ideas like hypnotism, mass hysteria, that using actual psychological tricks at the table that, you know, people use for a variety of entertainment and nefarious purposes to create a mood at the table, to work people up the exact same way.
Hiring a bum to bust through the door.
See, I use the whispering thing a lot. I'll just kind of say stuff under my breath or kind of while I'm doing something else, kind of keep that sound going. And people kind of listen like, is he really saying something? And then if they hear something that catches their, you know, they actually recognize something, sometimes it does freak them out. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. And you have to have players who are in the right mood. If they're joking around or not really buying it, just quit, because you can't convince players to buy into that mood unless they're ready for it.
This is perfect GMing advice from Melina, since everybody else who's playing in the game listens to or is on this podcast.
Does Melina GM?
No.
So how's that going to help?
Perfect GMing advice for me, for Melina.
Yeah, well, and you should know how to scare your wife. I mean, take off your pants. Do what you got to do.
Trust me, I know.
That's the other thing, too. If you know people better, you can get in their heads a lot more. If you know kind of what freaks people out, you don't want to go to their worst fear, but if you know they don't like spiders, you know, start adding those that kind of imagery to the game, and they'll pick up on it, and they'll be a little creeped out by it.
Have you ever met someone who really, really doesn't like spiders?
Yes.
Because they wouldn't just be a little creeped out by
it. I really, really don't like spiders.
Really?
But not enough that I'm arachnophobe, but I'm not a huge fan of them.
I used to game with an arachnophobe, like... That was it.
Huh.
And no, he'd like get up and leave.
In the middle of a game?
Well, no, playing on EQ2 against the spider mobs, he could barely do it.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That dude needs help.
He didn't like it at all.
No, I mean, that when EQ2 mobs are bothering you to that degree, it's time to go see.
He was like, they have long legs and they're hairy. These are the bad kind.
Isn't that when you type in, like, the pizza thing to order a pizza to your house?
No, that's EQ2. You type in /pizza every time. I'm talking about EQ2.
Oh, this is an EQ2. Yeah.
Thanks for listening, Repager. Way to go again.
Adam and I were talking about /pizza on Eve the other day.
Yeah.
I was coveting
it. I had to validate that because Adam's like, really? John's telling me about this pizza thing. Is that even true?
Of course it's true.
Like, yeah.
No, you didn't know.
I did too.
You were like,
I told you I knew.
I think it was this pizza thing.
Oh, think like... my ass. It made every FARC /dot, well, that whole circuit when it came out.
Hold on. Let me preface this. When I am Dan, it was, if this is true, why have you not said anything about this before? I would have continued to play EQ2.
I know it's real. I have used /pizza to order a pizza before. Back when I was still playing EQ2. I actually two or three times used /pizza to order pizzas while I was playing EQ2.
Damn it. Why do more games not do this?
This should be on everything. Everything should have
Microsoft Fear the Boot /pizza.
Microsoft
Word should
have
pizza key
slash
on
pizza.
My keyboard. I don't even want to get a slash one. Pizza.
If I type pizza in a cell in Excel, it should order a pizza for me.
What if you're just writing about pizza and you accidentally do it, though?
Well, then you got to lie in the bed you made.
This is going to help you get in character. All right.
I'm not programming this stuff.
Outside of the players aren't into it.
Uh-huh.
What else have you found that screws up the horror games? Common pitfalls, things people think would work but really doesn't.
Trying to scare the characters instead of the players is the number one. If you're trying to put stuff in the game that's just, oh, you know, oh, this big scary monster is doing this. No, you need to have that big scary monster do stuff that's going to freak people out and make people think, wait, this thing's kind of creepy. This isn't right. Throw in a bunch of surreal things, stuff that doesn't even make sense. You don't have to explain it. You just have to keep them unsettled.
Yeah. 38 hit dice will not scare them the way an unexplained statement will.
Exactly. Just something hanging in the air that doesn't add up with anything else is going to freak them out more than you put the 3-foot miniature on the table.
That's two things I found that have worked. Is one is mystery. Leave the characters guessing. Don't ever let them have a complete handle on the situation. And once again, this our players.
Which is about horror. Horror is being out of control.
Right.
You are not in control of the situation.
And in this case, with the player's under no real threat. And so the only thing you can take away from them is understanding. And so you kind of leave the situation not completely confusing, because then it's just like, what the hell is going on?
Right.
It becomes pointless. But you leave enough mysterious that they don't quite know what's going on. And then secondly, is you build that fear slowly. You don't have to do it all at once. You don't, okay, they're not going to be scared until they encounter this one monster and my description is good. No, work up to that. Just have little things. Like, I remember I was running a D&D game, one of the few horror-esque games I ever ran. And they were in the house of this necromancer. It's just little things. Like, they went up to the bedroom, and beneath the mirror in the bedroom, the guy had engraved on the mirror, "Till death do us part." It's just little things like that. Mm-hmm. That just the guy's house, the more they looked around, just all this weird kind of psycho stuff he had done to his house.
Well, and you hit the nail on the head. Start out at normalcy, because they have, it's a good contrast to see how far down the rabbit hole you can go. Because if you start out with something that's completely wild to start out with, people are going to be, they won't be unsettled. They're just going to kind of go, okay, well, I can't identify with this. They kind of unplug. If
you
start
with
what they know.
Really well was Myst. You would walk into their rooms and everything would be in order. And then you would start up opening drawers and there'd be like syringes and money in the one guy's room. And the other one would just be skulls and candles and crazy crap.
The creeping and ominous fear is one of the best kinds. The one that just kind of sneaks up on you as you realize more and more that something isn't right with this. My high watermark as a GM is I ran a classic Deadlands campaign back in college that actually gave two or three of the members nightmares for about a week, which I'm very, very proud of.
Can you give us a little, I mean, I know we try to avoid gaming stories, but how did you put
much
this
to
in
the
practice?
Dismay of so many forums.
Yeah, well,
until we do it, and then they're like, "Oh, stop telling gaming stories. It's boring."
Well, they hate every gaming story except for theirs.
Except for ours.
No, I hate all your gaming stories.
So, can you give me, a little bit on how you did this, how you executed that?
Well, the good thing about Deadlands is you can have a mysterious past you don't know about. So, there's a part of your character you don't even know about. And when these characters were generated, which I ran, it was a group of about 8 people. And I wasn't really trying to go for that scary, but it just turned out that way because everybody's backstories and the mysterious past they didn't know about intersected and came out in a way that really frightened people. One person had a helpful ghost that was haunting him, but he didn't know it was helpful. He didn't know what was going on. This thing kept trying to communicate with him, and it was freaking him out because he was seeing all this horrible imagery everywhere. Another character was Harrowed, which is basically undead in Deadlands, and didn't know about it. So all this time, these people are finding out, like, they'll be trapped in a room with him, and they'll start smelling rotting meat. And there's all this stuff that nobody really could put together. But at the end of the game, when he ends up being riddled with bullet holes and fine, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, and you're undead, by the way. As I walked out of the room that time because the game was over. I'm like, oh, yeah, by the way, you got shot a bunch of
times. He sees dead people. He sees Bruce Willis.
Yeah,
ergo.
They're just talking about it like this. It doesn't even, this stuff doesn't sound very scary. But when we did it in the game, and it was a slow revelation, it was. And like
your gaming stories scare me.
Yeah, as well they should. You should never play under me. It's terrible. It's a bad time. But that is my high watermark as a GM. It's great.
That sounds pretty cool. I want to run a game where someone is a replicant and he doesn't know who it is.
I think I've heard of a story like that before.
I have two. It's called Blade Runner Galactica. And I enjoy it a lot.
I hope they never do Battlestar Galactica in HD because I don't think it could handle Edward James Olmos' face in that kind of clarity.
Nothing can.
The Blade Runner briefcase 5-disc set is coming out in December.
Did you ever play the PC game?
No, but I want to.
Good luck.
Did you have it?
Good luck finding it.
I was about to say,
now.
It's nowhere.
Try to look online. I'm sure you can find it somewhere.
I don't know about that. First listener that gets me the Blade Runner video game, I don't know what you'll get, but it's something.
John will give you the second cougar of the night.
I will. Second.
Luke, you were talking about having a player character who was an undead.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Luke, what are your thoughts on the undead?
I love the undead. Favorite villains of all time.
Why?
Adam and Nathan, because they're great.
Are they all necessarily villains?
Not necessarily, but generally, yes. Zombies, vampires, ghosts, what have you. I love the undead. Just like I love dots. Dots and undead. Put those in a game, I'll play it forever. Hell, that's vampire. What am I talking about?
So
that's why I like vampires so much.
Lich or lick?
It's a lich.
Thank you.
All the way back to Final Fantasy I, where I learned the term.
Lich, the lord of the earth? That makes no sense.
Then lick?
Yeah, no, he was a lich.
Lord of the earth.
He was the undead guy, but he had the earth crystal or whatever. The other ones corresponded to their elements.
Well, actually, some cultures find that when they have undead theory, they're tied to the earth.
It's tied to the earth, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Those cultures are wrong.
Well, I probably.
That was very prominent.
In Dracula.
That was very prominent in Shadow Hearts. Where
and it was very prominent in Dracula.
Undead characters were always earth, not darkness or whatever.
And then in most vampire lore, where you don't just stake them, you stake them to the ground. That is how you kill a vampire.
Carry the earth of their homeland with them.
I think vampire or undead in general make such creepy villains because of the fact that obviously they tie back to our own death.
Yeah, that's really the root of horror,
you know,
I think.
With the dragon, there's something scary about it, but it's something escapable. You can kill it or get away from it. But death is one of those things, you know, looking at an undead is a reminder of ultimately your own mortality. and it's something unlike the dragon that you can't escape.
And they don't blink, and that freaks me out.
And they don't
they blink. Don't blink. They
sometimes, yeah,
the
last undead I saw didn't blink either.
Sometimes they just don't.
I've enjoyed, though, having undead as player characters, even not necessarily in evil games. Characters, you know, not quite the crow thing, but something like that, mm-hmm. where something brought them back from the dead, that the, you know, the death just couldn't contain them for whatever reason. Because of the fact that it creates immediately a background with hooks.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fact is the person died, so there's a story there. And the fact is that something about that death left their life unfulfilled.
See, I've had a lot of PCs who are undead in Deadlands because Harrowed is a common thing to happen to people who are very heroic. You come back as undead because the evil spirits in the setting like to take over the bodies of the people who are the most highly skilled. So you are back, but you're not completely in control. Every now and again, the evil spirit, the Manitou, actually takes control of you.
Right.
So you have a little bit to worry about.
I've played that also even in D&D. I don't know that I've had any player characters do this just because no one's ever asked. But I've had some friendly NPCs that were undead from, once again, not evil, just more, I don't know, not quite revenants, but they died and there was something about their death that unsettled them. There was something they wanted to complete, a love that was unfulfilled, or,
well, sure,
you know, the revenge is, I think, kind of the overplayed story there. If you're going to play an undead character in a campaign or write one, I would, first recommendation is I'd steer away from the revenge story because it is so absolutely overdone in movies, novels, and role-playing games that I was murdered by so-and-so and my wife was raped, so I'm back from the dead for revenge.
See, but
that was the plot of Gladiator.
See, the thing is, that's so trite, you can put a good twist on it, though, to make players think it's that and then pull the old switcheroo out. That's a good one-shot game right there, or, you know, story arc, what have you. You know what I like that doesn't happen? Well, it's happening more and more is the undead in sci-fi. Because the sci-fi authors always tend to put a pretty good twist on the undead. For instance, in Halo, you have the Flood, who are fantastic undead, who someday I will probably port to an RPG. Or in Half-Life 2, you have headcrabs. Who doesn't love headcrabs? And headcrab zombies. They're not real zombies, but they're zombies. They're, for all intents and purposes, again, something to be great in an RPG.
Those things in Serenity are close enough.
Reavers?
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's so many angles you could even do this from sci-fi, where nanites have reconstructed the body or some biological creature has taken over the brain capacity, but the body's still fundamentally functional, or you're a cyborg to the point that even with the flesh dead, the robot still keeps functioning and some amount of the flesh is still alive.
There are some cultures that believe if you were killed in a broadsides attack, you don't really die. You continue on living.
That's to get revenge. You continue living because they rolled the broadside, so now the starboard side is spared while the port side comes to the fore.
But you can roll a cube 6 times.
You can, but ultimately,
why don't you just do a sphere? You're just constantly rotating. Death Star only with a lot of cannons, a lot of primary lasers.
Oh, like a Borg ship from Star Trek. Yeah, I think you have to have crazy Borg technology to actually motivate that thing in a direction.
They'll get out and push.
Lord Nelson didn't have cube sphere propulsion systems.
God,
anyway, back to the undead and how great they are as villains in general. They're also fun because they're tough, and they can come at, like, zombies are great because they can come at you in hordes. They're fairly easy to kill if you take
them
on singly.
That's probably the best thing about zombies. It's like, well, where'd these zombies come from? They're zombies.
There's a million different reasons.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like everywhere. Undead always have one of two advantages.
Numbers?
Either numbers or limited invulnerabilities.
No, they don't sleep,
they don't eat,
that's the big advantage over humanity.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
For their persistence.
Persistence, I'll give you a third one.
Well, that's part of limited invulnerability, I think.
Yeah, so I was debating whether to lump that in there or not, but by limited invulnerabilities, I mean, like with a vampire, shooting them isn't sufficient. You know, that you have to do something more than that to them to hurt them.
Even your standard idiot zombie can typically take more punishment than something that would bleed
just
and fall over of injury.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
but the psychological impact of a zombie, like, okay, you close the gate, but you can still see the zombie, you sleep. The zombie never does. It's always clawing, trying to get at you.
And of course, there's always the infectious route too. You know, zombie scratches or bites. You know, you don't. The one thing you worry about is contact with them. It's just they're so corrupting as an influence.
Right.
That's always fun.
Well, the same thing with vampires, mummies. I mean, any of these other things that have something they can pass on to you, which might turn you into one of them, or might just flat out, plain old boring, kill you. But there's something to avoid there.
Guys, look, I want to go trick or treating. I want some candy. So we're going to end this now. We're done talking about undead.
And I want to be there to do creepy things when Luke comes to my house looking for candy. So thank you guys for...
Trick or treat, baby!
So thank you guys for tuning in, and be sure to stick around because we are going to tune this one out with the two parody episodes. So when you hear the music, that's not us ending. That's just something else beginning. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Enjoy the pick.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. The first spoof we're going to play is by Meg, Josh, and Zeke from Brilliant Gameologists. Thank you guys for your entry, and I hope the rest of you enjoy.
Welcome to Fear Dan Boot, a Dan cast about tabletop games, battle tech, and a little bit more about Dan. My name is Dan.
My name is Adam.
My name is Luke.
My name is John.
And of course, they are trying to mess you up because John always goes first, except on alternate weekends during Mardi Gras.
I have never gone first.
Yes, you have.
Could we please discuss this some more?
I think that this is a waste of time. However, I have three quick points to make, and I am going to make those points in the reverse order of how I thought of them. Here in St. Louis, we are noted for our sense of brevity.
Was that a point?
No, that was a statement of fact. Here's the thing. John, you are correct in the sense that I always go first, so you could not possibly have gone first. Luke, you are wrong.
About John?
No, in general. We have moved on to a new topic.
What about your third point?
I gave them in reverse order, so my first thought, as always, is how awesome a GM I am. And that is a good segue into our topic for today.
My comparison of roller disco to Battletech is a good segue?
No, we'll cut that.
Son of a...
But before I so handsomely segue, I have announcements. Our continuing ban on announcements continues to continue. So read the boards to find out about the following topics. Worldwide Wing Night, number 17, John's official Cougar fan club, and we are still looking for people to join the official Dan Appreciation Society. Also, we officially apologize to the following people. Cher's Hairdressers, 1984 to present. Gene Kelly and James Hepburn, the official Duke of Orkney.
Now, I'm a real doctor. So I have to say that I did not agree with what everyone said about my man James.
Speaking of Orkney, let's give a shout out to Daniel Perez, Ryan Dancy, and anyone else famous we might know.
I once shook Mr. T's hand. I found his grip firm.
Here's the thing. We hope you notice our sound quality is much better. We had a street person come in and adjust our compress-a-doodle.
I pity the fool. I too pity
a homeless
fools.
Man down on the freeway had a sign that said, "We'll mix audio."
Real doctors
food.
Like me pity people all the time.
His hands were soft.
Mr. T moisturizes.
I think he has let himself
He also
go
had a sign that said, "We'll trade
He is
food
tougher than
sex.
A real doctor
so
like
I
me.
So I cut out the middleman and just had sex with him.
Anyway, as Longhair was just saying about today's topic.
Right. Here's the thing. Today's topic is something we've been wanting to talk about for a long time.
I'm really excited. Me too.
I like it when you're excited, Adam.
Here's the thing. Today's topic is what to do when your PCs want to go to clown college, but your world revolves around a mentor-student relationship.
In Savage Worlds, there are a plethora of clown colleges.
I have strict entrance requirements to all my educational institutions.
I just supply the PCs with Bud Light.
If they just played Battletech like they were supposed to.
I've never actually seen a clown.
I can bring you to the circus.
Your birthday is next week. I could get you a clown.
The circus has like 50 or more clowns.
I can make love.
Now, here's the thing. As everyone knows, I am an awesome GM. I am to GM as Alan Greenspan is to economics.
Seabiscuit is to horses.
Michael Jordan is to baseball. No, wait. Pass.
Bud Light is to beer.
Here's the thing. I am an awesome GM. And the best solution is to do things my way. Now, you could just let your players go to clown college. That is awful and morally reprehensible. The state should take your children away and cart you off to jail. But you can do that if you want.
People who let players get away with that disgust me. The things they do would sicken a dog. But they are free to decide for themselves.
I think players should be allowed to go.
I agree with you there, Luke. Players should not get what they want under any circumstances.
Actually, I just said that
Anywho,
they should be...
we're out of time. Thank you for tuning in to your weekly dose of Ban.
See ya.
So long.
Next time, we will talk about how to handle panda insemination in your Battletech game.
That'll be my everything.
This has been a production of Fear Dan's Boot.
The second spoof we're going to play is by Tim White, who's also the composer of our intro music. And I hope you guys enjoy this one as well.
Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Adam.
And my name is Lucius, but too many people think it sounds like luscious, so you can call me Luke. Did I mention that I had a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 at dinner? At dinner? You had it for dinner. Ha ha. Just to let everyone know, John couldn't make it today. He was attacked by a pack of cougars. And last I heard, Tex was tied to a server rack somewhere in Redmond by his new girlfriend.
Do cougars even travel in packs? In the D&D Rulecyclopedia, they did. I love you, Rulecyclopedia.
Anywho, I'd just like to get the ball easing down the road by apologizing for what we said in episode number one.
Episode one? By Hard Gaze Hat, will you quit apologizing? We're on, like, episode 76.
Sorry, what? I was cleaning my gun.
Oh, right, apologies. I wanted to apologize for saying we didn't like gamer stories. In truth, it's more of a Nietzsche thing. We just like to believe they don't exist.
No. Did they teach you that in that fancy doctoring school?
No! It was one of the trivia questions at the bar where we had dinner! Of course they taught it to him at optometry school! Oh! Woo! Did they have trivia there? I just remember drinking me a good dinner.
Let me just mention at this point that this is a parody episode, and that if this is your first time listening to Fear the Boot, you might go back and listen to one of our regular episodes first, like number 20. That's a great one. Very representative of the FTB oeuvre.
Number 20? Which one was that?
Oh, it'll come to you. Think about James Bond's favorite drink.
Drinks? Righteous! Have I told you guys about my Savage Burning Wheelie game yet? It's a genre mashup between Godzilla movies and women in prison movies. You remember those hot twins from Mothra? You know, Mothra! Dang, I do remember them. They were like in that little cage.
Was this a show on the History Channel? If not, I probably missed it. It's all the TV I ever watch, other than when Carla forces me to watch Star Trek.
History Channel? Well, maybe on the History of Awesome Channel. Anyway, everyone plays tiny chicks in cages who can summon freaky huge monsters just by singing.
And of course, with all those girls in such a little cage, you know what else is happening. pearl diving in the fishbowl of our own eyes?
Oh, you know it!
Wow, that'll be imprinted in my mind's eye for a while. Well, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Woo!
Oh, God. Well, anyway, on to our main topic for today.
Main topic? We only just started the show. It took us longer than this to get Texas Skype working in episode 73.
Well, this is a parody episode, and we don't have a lot of time to explore the banter space.
Fine, whatever.
Woo! Let's get this train out of the station. Our main topic for today is pencils.
Pencils? Our main topic is pencils? How much can we say about pencils?
Did you know that the average pencil has better eyesight than Nietzsche did? Oh. My. God. Come on, Adam. Pencils are an important part of gaming. You use them to fill out your character sheet, to take notes on my complex and expansive plot lines, to move minis that are too far away to reach, and to stab Phil when he starts dancing.
I can't believe we've run so dry of material that we are discussing pencils.
Hey, Savage Worlds actually requires that you use pencils. If you use a pen, you start taking like one hit per round from a phantom force.
Really? Is that true?
It is now. I set it on Fear the Boot. Yeah, good point. Someone go edit Wikipedia for us, quick.
You know what I just realized? Sometimes Fear the Boot is the definition of truthiness.
Truthiness? Is that one of your made-up fervert words?
Fervert? You call me a fervert? I've seen the way you look at your dogs.
Did I mention I was cleaning my gun?
Woo!
That's all the time we have for today, folks. Join us next time on Fear the Boot.
Oh. My. God.
Woo! This has been a production of Tim White. Music by Tim White. Bad jokes by Tim White. All celebrity voices were impersonated. Poorly. The show copyright 2007 by Tim White.
Where did these huge sideburns come from all of a sudden? Oh, you can't get that from drinking Mad Dog, can you?